This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. I wanted to talk about the social sciences being bullied by the political mob, and it seems to be coming from all sides. I'm sure many of you have heard about the whole thing with George Sicariello Marr. I hope I pronounced his name right, from Drexel. Have you heard about this guy?
Remind us.
Okay, so I mean, I don't know him personally, and I haven't read his work. He seems to be a serious Latin Americanist, and he's on Twitter. And personality-wise, he seems like one of these provocative types. And he's basically, I think he's trolling conservatives. He tweets about things like trying not to vomit or yell about Mosul when someone gave a soldier a first class seat on a flight. And he tweeted things like, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." Oh. And I should say that he's white also. Uh-huh. Okay, just to be clear on that. And he says it's satire, and it's trolling, I think. It's not my cup of tea. I don't think it...
I agree. Trolling sounds like a good word for it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really feel like this type of stuff is, like, down the path towards the good society, but whatever. And Breitbart and the whole David Horowitz style type, you know, liberal professors are poisoning kids' minds. That whole scene jumped all over him. And then recently from the other side, have you heard about this Third World Quarterly retraction?
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'll just, in case somebody hasn't heard about it, this... So I don't know if this is satire as well. I mean, if it isn't, then I don't know really what to say about it. It's basically an article that was published, I guess, about the plus sides of colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds a lot like people who argue, you know, that we're ignoring the upside of slavery to black people, or maybe
Michelle. I read it and I was like, oh, that's like when Michelle Bachmann said, well, you know, at least in slavery, the black family was intact.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Until you sew them away from each other. But
yeah. Footnote. But I mean, I didn't read the paper. It's not on my reading list. But anyhow, the Third World Quarterly retracted the article, citing threats of violence to the journal editor as the reason for retraction. So it wasn't the content itself, but rather it was directly cited the presence of threats.
And this closely follows the model of the Hypatia thing about 6 months ago.
What's that?
So there was a feminist journal, I believe it was a feminist journal, and somebody wrote a philosophy piece basically saying that there's no way in principle to distinguish between transgender and transracialism. And people were not happy about that. I think there were like board resignations or things like that to push the journal to retract the article. And what's funny about that is one of my colleagues has made a very similar argument, and it hasn't really gotten appreciable pushback, certainly not from within the discipline. It's just treated as like, this is a reasonable topic of inquiry. Although he has more of a, less of a normative take, and more of just like a, isn't it interesting that people, treat gender as plastic, but race is essential, even though both are socially constructed.
Did the article end up retracting in that case?
I believe so. I know it was really controversial, and you know, the journal kind of went back and forth, and I don't remember all the ins and outs, but I do know that there was criticism, that the people criticized the article and the journal for publishing it for not kind of towing the party line, and then they retracted or did something along those lines, and then there was pushback to the pushback and backlash to the backlash to the backlash, turtles all the way down.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of feel like with that argument, regardless of what side you're on, I actually think having it published and then having people chime in to say why they believe it's wrong, right?
Right.
That's what comments and replies or writing your own article that cites it critically is for. There's a big difference between if I think, you know, Hinks in 2017 is the, you know, dumbest, most offensive argument I've ever seen, you know,
impossible.
I'm going to ask the editor to do a comment and reply to your article, or maybe I'll just write my own article that cites you and says why you're wrong. But I'm not going to say that you should, that your article should be retracted, unless I think it's simply wrong on the empirics. Not that I disagree with it, but like if I think like, yeah, but even then, like in sociology, we traditionally do comment and replies, even if we think somebody did a math error that made the article.
Yes.
You know, the only reason that we would ask for a retraction is if something is outright fraudulent.
Right.
Which is different from being normatively unethical.
Yeah, what strikes me here is that I thought a retraction was for very specific circumstances, and one of them was a negative outside reaction to a paper. So it's kind of striking that this is happening. On the other hand, I guess neither of these people strike me personally as very sympathetic in the way they, you know, either what they're advocating or the way they go about things. And I don't know, like, what's your feeling on this? Is this a failure on the part of the institutions, like on the part of Drexel or Third World Quarterly? Or should we be talking about, you know, codes of professional conduct and ask whether these two guys are transgressing any type of...
My feeling is I don't want to know what my opinion is of these things substantively, both because they're outside my area, so it's kind of wasting my time, but also because once you start getting into the specifics, you're no longer talking about principle. And to me, there's a very strong principle.
Yeah, no. So for me, I was wondering, because I did read that article, The Case for Colonialism, and my question was, isn't there peer review here? There were so many things in this article that I thought to myself, you know, like I could have cited reams of evidence, right, that totally went against this and said, hey, you know what I mean? You want to contextualize this a little bit? I don't know how it made it through peer review unless the intention was to have it in there to be provocative.
Oh, because there's a lot of stuff. I mean, there's this irony, right, in that we always think, like, how can I get things through peer review? It takes a year, year and a half to get through review with all the R&Rs and everything. But just look at how much crap is published, right? Sure. I mean, saying that crap gets published is like saying the sun rises in the east. There's just so much stuff published, and most of it sucks. So that's not surprising to me.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that he says here is that, you know, one of the really good things about colonialism is that, I'm trying to find the quote, is that, you know, it ended slavery. And I was thinking to myself, which colonies is he talking about, and at which periods of time? Because in order for many colonies to thrive, there needed to be a slave trade.
I haven't read the article, but I'm going to guess that this is the distinction between, like, 16th, 17th century colonialism and 19th and 20th century colonialism. Because I know that there were places where colonial empires ended the local slave trade in the late 19th and early 20th century, even though they expanded and changed the nature and made more international the slave trade in that, you know, early modern era.
Yeah, well, you can't pick and choose. And he doesn't distinguish between the two eras here. And, you know, he talks about the Congo and, you know, and how the Congo was good under Portuguese colonialism.
Wait, Portuguese or Belgian?
I mean, sorry, Belgian. Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, did he not read King Leopold's Ghost?
Well, all I know is from Tintin comics. And so on that basis, you know.
It struck me, I saw this thing on Twitter where it was like a neo-Nazi comes out as being Jewish and gay. Uh-huh. And I'm like, thanks, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
You know, I think this is up for argument, right? If only because I think there are lots of people out there who think that bringing back colonialism is good, who think that, you know, ending colonialism was bad for a lot of countries. And it would be great to, you know, to have a really well thought out and researched response to this.
Do you really think that's on the table? You really think that, like, you know, Belgium has 20,000 troops ready to go back into Congo at a moment's notice?
No, he's trying to argue that Belgium should actually consider going back in.
Well, I don't doubt that there's somebody saying that, but I'm saying, is it realistically on the table?
Oh, he's saying that, I don't think that it's realistically on the table. What he's saying is that many of these former colonies would actually welcome, or at least should welcome, their former colonizers or new colonizers coming in so that they could fix their infrastructure problems. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that like advocating for, like, the World Bank coming in, though? No, I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, here, well, that's what I was saying. I was like, isn't that what the World Bank already does to some extent? But
I don't know. What about this this guy George Sicariello? I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, though. With the trolling on Twitter and getting suspended for it by Drexel. What's your reaction to that?
You know what? That's like really, it's really hard Because part of me thinks if you're trolling and you're doing it on your own time and you're not targeting other people in your field, is it our business to police you for doing that, right? But at the same time, you know, I guess if you're out there doing that and people can trace you back to the institution, does that look bad on your institution?
But like, there's the flip side of that happened this week as well. There's a really popular sort of pop financial analyst called Mark Faber, who's always on CNBC. He basically was talking about on his, I think it was on Twitter or something like that, about how, I guess, white people deserve credit for, it was just something patently racist, like America should be glad it's predominantly white or something like that. Isn't that the flip side? Like, if he's on his own time talking about that, should he be kicked off the air? Or?
My feeling about this is that, you know, the Drexel guy sounds like an asshole, and I wouldn't want to, but I also think he has his academic freedom. That if he is just kind of doing this on his own time, especially if he doesn't list the university in the bio or otherwise trying to fill it, you know, actively identify it with the university. Although even if he did, I'd kind of think like, you know, for identification purposes only, so what, right? I mean, I identify myself as being at UCLA at the beginning of this podcast, and I feel like if the chancellor of UCLA doesn't like something I say in the course of the podcast, that's his problem. I have tenure. I have academic freedom. So this guy seems to have very low value speech, right? He's not saying anything particularly valuable, but I still think just as a point of principle, you have to grant him academic freedom, you know, in order in part to protect high value speech without it turning down to what do you think on the merits?
Yeah, you know, when I remember my freshman year in undergrad, and I remember one of our RAs, we got into a heated conversation about colonialism and about empire and about race. And and I will never forget this. He said, well, you know what? If it wasn't for people like me, right? You know, who knows where you'd be? I think you should thank me because you don't live in a mud hut and you still have your clitoris. Right. So thank me for that.
Yeah. That's pretty fucking offensive. I mean,
It is, but I mean, how different is that from, you know, from this financial analyst and what he's saying?
Much different in my eyes. Like, in my eyes, students are you know, when you have a particular student, I feel like we're stewards of their well-being and that type of thing in a classroom setting.
It wasn't a classroom setting. When I say RA, it's a residential assistant.
Oh, excuse me.
He lives in the dorm with you and he's an upperclassman. And as fellow students, we're having a conversation.
I don't know. That for me, that's different. For me, I see students as young. We're responsible for them in my eyes. And that to me is sort of core mission.
There's also a difference between saying something in general and saying something to another person. You know, I think the second person changes it.
You think? I mean, why?
Well, in one case, it's a statement of how you think in principle. In the other case, it's an attack. And if someone overhears you, kind of my feeling is that if somebody overhears me saying something that they disagree with, but it's not said to them, then that's kind of their problem. Whereas if I say something to someone with a reasonable expectation that they'd be offended by it, then that's kind of on me.
Huh, that's interesting.
I just feel like professors have a special responsibility towards their students that, you know, it's not like talking in the public sphere. There's power dynamics. I think we have a responsibility and not just professors, but anybody in the, you know, anybody who's sort of at a university who someone has some type of authority over. I feel it's just very different from speaking on Twitter, for example. You have to actively seek out his views. Whereas, I mean, and you can always unfollow him. What's a student going to do? Like move out of residence?
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.